This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge.
On the 19th of November 2008, our guest speaker was Professor Michel Devroy of the Université Catholique de Louvain, speaking on the theme Keynes, Marshall and the General Theory. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thank you, Mark, for the invitation. So my paper, the aim of the paper is to answer the following question. What are the implications of anchoring Keynes' theory more firmly in Marshallian analysis, the implication for the robustness of his argumentation? The paper will comprise three parts. First one will be a discussion of Marshall, and I shall claim that at the end of the discussion that actually there is no serious theory of market rationing, and for that matter of unemployment, in Marshall. This motivates the second section of the paper, which is what were the contributions that were provided between Marshall and Keynes on the topic of unemployment. And there we shall see that the notion of frictional employment will be put forward, but it will be very weak in terms of theory. It will just be an evocation, but hardly an explanation. So what this means is that when Keynes started his work, he was facing a vacuum. There were no real theory of unemployment before him, I would argue. Then the point that I'm dealing with in my discussion of Keynes is to see, first I shall show that Keynes was really just extending Marshallian theory, so that many of the features of Marshallian theory are also present in Keynes' theory. And then the question that shall be raised is, was Keynes able to go beyond Marshall in terms of providing a robust explanation of unemployment? Before entering into the discussion, I would like to make one preliminary methodological remark, which refers to a distinction that was made by Leonfoot, and it's a distinction between the notion of a theory and the notion of a model. A theory, according to Leonfoot, is a set of beliefs about reality, and their aim is to draw a truth proposition about reality. While a model would be something which is narrower, it's a formal representation of these beliefs or of a part of it, where the emphasis is put on the rigor of demonstration or the inferences, on the effort of trying to make a demonstration in the strong sense of the term. Usually, now models are mathematical, but they can also be in prose, or they can be based on graphs as Keynes' time. But nonetheless, there is a distinction between the two. A theory understood in that way can be discussed on its own term, but it presents many drawbacks. The main drawback is that the discussion will have some difficulty to progress, in the sense that hermeneutic questions will arise all the time. So the advantage of a model is that there the aim of studying the consistency of the model comes to the forefront. My paper is concerned, as you will see, is concerned less with Marshall and Keynes' theory as with the way in which they try to modelize their theory. And so when I shall speak of them, I shall use the word theory, but you should understand it as meaning, in Leonfoot's term, as meaning a theory. As meaning a model. Okay. I shift to Marshall, to my first part. And so actually I shall skip, because my paper may be too long, so I shall skip some aspects, and I shall go at once to the central part, which is the central claim that in Marshall there is no theory about the possibility. There is no explanation of a possible rationing in any market and also in the labor market. So there is no, strictly speaking, a Marshallian theory of unemployment. Marshall was mainly interested in what would be called long period equilibrium, but in his term it was normal equilibrium, which served as a center of gravitation for daily market outcomes. But he also studied, I would say, the outcome of a market at the unit at a unit period of exchange, and that we can find in his chapter two of book five of the Principles. And let me now retrace the argument in this chapter. So I don't know whether you are familiar with this chapter, but it's a very short chapter, and it tells a story, but which is actually a model. It's more, but about the working of a corn market in a small city in the UK, in England. And he starts at once saying, what is the equilibrium price? It's 30 shillings and 70 quarters will be exchanged. What Marshall is interested is in not finding what is the equilibrium price, but in a story which is which is the question to be asked, how can that equilibrium be attained? And then he goes with us saying that there will be a haggling between purchasers and sellers, and claiming that eventually a given price, the equilibrium price, which he calls the true equilibrium, 30 shillings will impose itself. So the reader will ask, what's the mechanism, the driving force behind this attainment? And we have to go beyond the rhetoric of haggling and bargaining, and then it turns out, in fact, that Marshall has just one explanation to provide. Namely, that equilibrium arises because agents have the ability to conjecture correctly market conditions. Actually, they have the ability to conjecture the shape of the demand and the supply functions, and hence to calculate mentally the equilibrium value, to the effect that all sellers would like to sell at a higher price, but all purchasers would like to buy at a lower price, and the only price that will impose itself is the true equilibrium price. So that's a very heroic assumption. Agents have perfect information about market conditions. Marshall himself is aware of the heroic character of that assumption, so he goes on in the same chapter introducing the assumption of a constant marginal utility of money, which allows me to have false trading at a rather low price, in the sense that eventually the market will come at the same equilibrium price, at least for the last trade, the same quantities being traded. And so he has that stimulated, very clever assumption of false trading. But then we must admit that this step of reasoning, which is quite clever, is also very ad hoc and certainly cannot be generalized. And actually, Marshall feigns to refer to it later on in his work. So the conclusion that we should draw is that because of that assumption, the market, Marshallian market, always features market clearing, or in other words, the matching of supply and demand. So that's a very important result. So if you adhere to the value, to Marshallian value theory, the only result that you are able to produce is the matching of supply and demand on a given market day. Any rationing result is thus excluded. Three additional remarks. First, once you adopt that perfect information, it turns out that all Marshall rhetoric about haggling and bargaining is just a sort of varnish. It's unnecessary. Likewise, the idea that there is a duration in the formation of equilibrium is of little importance. You could as well, by Occam's razor, say, well, equilibrium is attained instantaneously in logical time. Nothing is lost by making that assumption. Second remark. To Marshall, you must be aware that the study of market equilibrium is not first the central aspect of his theory, and second, cannot be separated from the more fundamental concept of equilibrium, which he calls normal equilibrium, and so which is the center of gravitation for market days. Then we must be that there is a point that must be very neatly made here, which is the following. The fact that there is market clearing does not preclude that the situation in point can be called a state of disequilibrium. Because in Marshall, disequilibrium is a situation where market prices and normal prices coincide. And so it may very well be the case that there is market clearing, but that actually that situation should be qualified as a state of disequilibrium. So market clearing is not a guarantee of equilibrium. And so a little graph from Marshall where you have the market supply functions which are vertical because we may refer to the fish market. We suppose that there is an increase in the normal demand. This is unforeseen so that the day where after the increase, the exchange will take place at point B. But that's the point of market clearing since there is a matching between market supply and demand. But that's also a point of disequilibrium. And so what is going on there is that from one period of time to the next, there will be an adjustment in production. More fish will be brought to the market up to the situation where C will be reached. But as long as C is not reached, we have a situation with market clearing, yet which qualifies as a state of disequilibrium. So, in market, we have frictions. If frictions is considered as synonymous to slow adjustment, but they can be present only as far as the adjustment towards normal equilibrium is concerned. They are absent from the formation of market equilibrium. So in that canonical model, it is incorrect to say that some market non-clearing would arise because of slow adjustment. It is not true. Slow adjustment may work, but not for the formation of market equilibrium. My third remark is the question whether Marshall's account of the corn market can be extended to the labor market. And my answer is yes. First, at the end of the Marshall himself states that the constant marginal utility of money assumption cannot be made in the case of the labor market. He also discusses labor supply, labor demand, but never returns to the discussion of their interaction, never suggests that there would be a specificity in the labor market so that it would work in another way than the corn market. So the conclusion to be drawn is that no other assumption. So if we want to have an outcome at the end of the market day, and if that outcome is to be an equilibrium, well, we should put it another way. So if we accept that there is no other assumption than perfect information as the mechanism of formation of equilibrium, if that assumption is present in the corn market, but also in the labor market, and Marshall is not saying anything else, then we should conclude that in Marshall's theory, the labor market also features a permanent market clearing. Not that Marshall did not mention unemployment. Actually, he did mention it, but it was not a central preoccupation to him. He was not fully silent on the issue of unemployment, but he had little interest in it. He was more interested in the problem of poverty. And just one quotation to show you what was Marshall's statement, this quotation from Matthew saying that cyclic unemployment was the next par excellence a volume two subject. That's a topic to be dealt with business cycle theory. But then Marshall made little progress in his business cycle theory and actually didn't write volume two of the principle. So that if we wanted to have a theory of Marshall's view about unemployment, the term theory would not be deserved. We would just have fragmentary aphoristic statements as stated by Matthews. So, next point is the following. That perfect information assumption is not only present in the corn market model, it's always present in the other parts of the principles. Of course, Marshall is a contradictory author, and you can draw a series of quotations where he would say the reverse. But if you look at his model and at what the prerequisites that are needed in order that his models work and reach the result that he intends them to reach, you will see that the same perfect information assumption is also present in the rest of the book, and in particular in one topic which is of interest for us which will be of interest for us later on, the topic of the firm's production decision in the short period. And here, if we read Marshall carefully, we see that the problem can be cast as follows. Firms have to decide what they need to produce. To that end, they need to make conjectures about what is happening in the input markets. So they must try to figure out what will be the price in the input markets, what will be the quantity produced, so that they could enter these inputs in their calculation of the production of the final good that they are going to do. And the problem is that at the time they have to make these decisions, then these variables are still virtual, so they don't know what they will be. So they need to conjecture these outcomes, in particular the labor market outcome. Now, if you read Marshall, you will see that in his analysis, which is first concerned with a firm's optimizing this production decision, that he jumps at once from the individual equilibrium of the firm to the interactive equilibrium of the market. So this means that he implicitly assumes that these conjectures are right. For otherwise, he should have entered into an analysis of what would happen when they are wrong, and this he doesn't do. So we must draw the conclusion that in Marshall, the determination of normal equilibrium in a given product market related to what happens in the input markets, well, this determination firstly occurs as a thought experiment in the minds of firms, in the firm managers, and then it becomes implemented as an objective observable market experiment only later on in a second stage. For this to be the case, firms need to have perfect information. It's how they conclude the next step to be made then is to say that if no corrective mechanism starts, this means that firms have made the right conjectures, that what they've integrated in their optimizing calculation is also the market clearing values in all these input markets. So here we have the same idea that we are in a world where equilibrium at the level of the market is always realized, even if these states of market equilibrium can be conceived in a wider way as states of disequilibrium with respect to the more fundamental concept of normal equilibrium. So this is the state of affairs that we find in Marshall. Then my paper continues to see whether an improvement is to be found over these issues in the writing of these authors who wrote between Marshall and Keynes. And three authors are examined in the paper. Beveridge, Unemployment's book, X Theories of Wages, and Pigou, Theory of Unemployment. So Beveridge, which is a pioneering book, starts with a criticism of standard economic theory, first of all, because of its neglect of unemployment. And so that's a good point with respect to my diagnosis. His point is, and then he takes it for granted at once, that the unemployment that should be explained is frictional unemployment. So this is taken for granted, and he also has no qualm to assert that frictional unemployment is involuntary unemployment. So he at once takes the a position opposed to that which Keynes is going to take later on. His explanation is very simple. He says frictional unemployment exists because there are many labor markets and they are squattered. So there is a plurality of non-connected labor markets. If the market would be centralized, there would be no problem. And so his policy conclusion is to say that what should be done is to organize labor markets in a better way and to centralize them as much as possible. I'm not going to, for all these books, I'm going to go very fast to the essential. The conclusion that must be drawn from this book, which is possibly the most interesting of the three books that I discuss here, because of its wealth of data and its very fine institutional analysis. The only drawback, and this is a serious drawback, is that there is no theory. So he evokes the notion of frictional unemployment, but has little explanation to offer about it. Is there something better to be found in X's book? So that book was published in 1932, and X was the first to recognize that it was not a very fine date for publishing a book like his own, like this book. His main point is a strange book, because his main message, I would say, is that pure theory is actually unable to grasp the problem of unemployment. So if we look at the conditions that exist in pure theory, we can make a list of them, but then he would say all these conditions are very artificial. And they may serve as a convenient model, but certainly they are not a description of what may happen in reality. And so, and his interest is, I want to explain reality. So that, for example, he states, and it is a central point, according to theory, the wage should decrease in the presence of unemployment. And it can be observed that this is not happening. Three reasons are advanced by X in this respect, and each of them associated with a type of unemployment. The first is the existence of unemployed people. The second one is the fact that there is frictional unemployment. And here again we see the term which is proposed, but very little explanation, except one remark which is interesting because it shows that in a way X anticipated modern search theory, saying his viewpoint is that this is an equilibrium position, because firms have no interest in changing their policy. So then the next possible explanation is the existence of trade unions. So all this is rather trivial and doesn't go very deep in a sort of explanation. In short, we have a three-pronged viewpoint. First, it is stated that pure theory is wanting in its possibility of explaining unemployment. It has little room for unemployment. Nonetheless, unemployment is an undeniable fact of life. So what is to be done? Well, it states there are discrepancies between pure theory, the model of pure theory, and reality. And so to explain unemployment, we need mainly to resort to factors relating to the interstices between them. This again amounts, amounts to foregoing giving unemployment a theoretical explanation. I would say that the same position is to be found in Pigou. So that's in his 1933 book. And so what is striking about Pigou is that he takes it as a verified fact that excess supply of labor is the normal state of affairs. So observing unemployment, he translates that into the theoretical discourse and saying there must be excess supply of labor. Hence, his analysis is conducted on the premise that labor demand is playing the active role in the determination of employment. And so he has, as it were, anticipating disequilibrium theory, he has a short side trading conception. So his view is that firms determine employment unilaterally. Now, that's a view which runs totally counter to the Marshallian view, where employment would be determined by the intersection of supply and demand. But then Pigou puts that view forward, but without really vindicating it. And so he devotes all his energy in that book trying to explain the whereabouts of the demand for labor. So, in short, in Pigou, there would be the assumption that it's not made explicit that we have a case of a fixed real wage rigidity, and then there will be short-sight exchange. I find personally that this book is very frustrating because it is a 300-page book, and the five-sixth first pages of it are about, I would say, a painstaking analysis of the whereabouts of the demand for labor, about its elasticity, and so on. The topic of unemployment starts only in page 247 of the 300 pages, and that to the effect that the reader is really very tired because of the previous type of exercise. And then what he finds is something which I find rather trivial and, again, insufficiently elaborated. And so just one quotation, that the sort of statement that you can find, in stable conditions, everybody is employed. The implication is that such employment as exists and as any time is due wholly to the fact that changes in demand conditions are continually taking place while there are frictional resistance which prevent the appropriate wage adjustment from being made instantaneously. Nothing more than that, just that. Frictions are the culprit, but nothing explains how they could enter a theoretical picture. So, the conclusion that can be drawn from this is that, contrarily to the impression that we can have when reading the general theory, there was no established theory of frictional employment that was existing before Keynes. So Keynes may give the impression that what he's doing is adding a theory of involuntary employment to an existing theory of frictional employment. I would argue that is not the case. There was almost nothing in terms of a robust explanation of unemployment. So that was the situation. It was a sort of dire situation. Now let me come to Keynes' general theory. So the first way of introduction, I would, of course, Keynes has been commented so much and there have been so many interpretations about it that this is an endless discussion. It's an industry in itself. My own characterization of Keynes' general theory would be that there is a program that is underlying it, and I would describe that program in 4 points. Keynes wanted first to demonstrate the existence of involuntary employment. Second, he wanted to demonstrate that wage rigidity could be exonerated from being its cause. Third, he wanted to give an interdependency explanation of the phenomenon. I would call it a general equilibrium explanation, except that term is often preempted by Walrasian theory, while Keynes was certainly not a Walrasian. But I believe that Walrasian theory should not have the monopoly over the term general equilibrium, so that I would say Keynes wanted to do a Marshallian general equilibrium explanation of unemployment within the framework of perfect competition. And finally, fourth, he wanted to demonstrate that demand stimulation were the proper remedy for the problem rather than wage inflation. So that was, Keynes did not spell his program in these terms, nor did his interpreters, but I have the opinion that this reconstruction is not contradictory to most interpretations of the general theory. The existing differences are more a matter of emphasis rather than straight incompatibilities. Let me go at once to, again, the central point of my claim, and which is a concentration of theory of Keynes' theory of effective demand. I guess that you are all aware of that theory. So his central claim is that the cause of unemployment lies in a deficiency of effective demand. So that's the central claim. Following Clower, I believe that we can interpret Keynes' argumentation in the light of Marshall's analysis analysis I referred above of firms' optimal short period production. And so Keynes' approach is just an extension of Marshall from a given firm, a given industry, to what would happen, I would say, in the whole manufacturing sector, possibly even in the whole economy. But then I would say the features that are present in the Marshallian analysis would also be present in Keynes. And my claim is that, although this is not often underlined, I believe that the formation of effective demand in Keynes ought to be accounted for along the same line as the formation of the equilibrium of the representative firm. This means, in particular, that we have, again, here the perfect information assumption. Firms construct in their minds what will be the economy, and they are right in this conjecture to the effect that what will effectively exist is what they fancied, what they mentally believed would exist. So the firms forge conjectures about aggregate supply price, aggregate demand price, and they derive demand function as their intersection. So no problem of realization is evoked. So the economy starts to unfold only in a second stage. So what the theory describes is at once what goes on in the minds of firms and how this thought experiment is effectively becoming reality. And even the assumption is even more heroic than in Marshall, since it doesn't concern one industry, it concerns the whole manufacturing sector and probably also the whole economy, because the other markets play a role as well. So two conclusions to be drawn from this. First, I would say that Keynes' theory of effective demand is less original than what might be believed. And second, again, in Keynes' argumentation, perfect information plays a central role. Now, we all know that in other parts of the general theory, Keynes is going to underline uncertainty. But then this follows from Marshall's strategy of having slicing in different sections of analysis, the short period, the long period, to the effect these are different analytical objects, so that with of course the drawback that there can be contradictions between what is stated about the short period and what is stated about the long period, and Keynes is certainly a good example of this. Then the question arises, what's the difference between effective demand à la Marshall and effective demand à la Keynes? So we see that Keynes is treating Marshall's footsteps, except that he's extending his analysis, but it's the same analysis. So what then would be the difference between the two authors? And my answer runs as follows. The only difference from the Marshallian reasoning is the view that firms incorporate in calculation the aggregate supply price, input costs, do not incorporate labor input costs at the market clearing value. So firms must be assuming that the wage rate which is taking place in the labor market is a false wage, that is a non-equilibrium, a non-market clearing price. So if we want to keep the assumption that firms are correct in their conjectures, and otherwise we would have a theory about learning, we must conclude that their incorporating a false wage in their conjecture follows from their correct anticipation that this is indeed what will happen in the labor market. So there must be a reason in the labor market explaining the lack of market clearing. And the only reason that can be conceived of is an exogenous wage floor, exogenous wage rigidity, which is, by the way, I should have said that earlier, is the only way in which market rationing could be introduced in Marshallian theory, by assuming some wage floor, a mandatory wage floor imposed by the state. But that's a very trivial exogenous explanation. But here we see that at the time, firms must be conjecturing that something goes wrong in the labor market, that what is wrong is the fact that market clearing is not attained, so that they need to incorporate a different wage in their conjecture. And the only explanation that is available at the time for this outcome is the existence of a wage floor, wage rigidity. So, claims to the contrary notwithstanding, it is difficult to escape the view that Keynes' effective demand does not result, that Keynes' effective demand result follows from a fixed wage hypothesis. The reason for unemployment lies in the labor market, and no fuss should be made about effective demand as being its cause. The existence of unemployment as a labor market phenomenon precedes logically the determination of effective demand rather than the other way around. Now, we all know that Keynes introduced that assumption of nominal wage rigidity in chapter 3 and in the rest of the book. But then he introduced it as serving only a simplifying purpose in the argumentation rather than being at the cause of the phenomenon. And he also claimed that he was to remove that assumption later in the book, and we shall discuss that presently. But at this juncture, we can already make the remark that the mere introduction of that assumption is quite intriguing. In effect, Keynes must have been very well aware that the wage rigidity assumption was the only possible explanation. So it was a rival to his own preferred explanation, demand deficiency. And then it's quite unusual, I find, to introduce a rival explanation as a simplifying device of one's own argumentation. And on top of that, it should be shown in which way it does make just a simplification. So in order to discard ambiguity, it would have been safer to avoid to refer to that rival explanation, be it at the price of having a more complicated argumentation. Okay, so next step is to see whether to enter into that Keynes argument. So in the argumentation given by Keynes as to the removal of that assumption which he made in chapter 3. But before, I must refer to one aspect which is the time framework of Keynes' analysis. For lack of time, I haven't focused on Marshall's time category, but it's in the paper. But it plays a role for the argumentation here. It is usually stated that Keynes' analysis is a short period analysis. And from X onwards, this has also been claimed about ISLM models. But then, is this so obvious? I don't think so. If the issue that is addressed in Keynes' effective demand theory is the emergence of the phenomenon of involuntary employment, the period of exchange, or the market day, to use Marshall's term, ought to be the relevant time framework for studying it. Because unemployment must necessarily occur on a given market day. Let me insist on this point. If we were making a discourse about reality that aims at describing reality at once, we may be looking at quarterly statistics and observe, for example, that unemployment has increased in a given percentage over the short period, that is a quarter of 3 months. But when it comes to a theoretical discourse, things ought to be different. First, we usually want the phenomenon of unemployment to emerge from a state of equilibrium where from it was absent before. Moreover, we need to be precise about its emergence. In particular, we need to point out the precise moment of its emergence, and to that end, we need to be explicit about the time organization assumptions underpinning the theoretical discourse. In Marshall, the market day is the unit period of exchange. So the emergence of involuntary employment would be a matter of something happening on a given market day. Stating that it arises over a succession of such market days is an imprecise statement, and as such it is unacceptable. So there is a conceptual ambiguity here. The state of affairs is as follows. Without stating it, Keynes studies the arising of involuntary employment on a given market day. But because of a semantic confusion, it is asserted that it is a short period analysis. Because of that evolution which led that Marshall's notion of a market day has become called a short period, while that notion of normal equilibrium has become a long period, we say that if it was just a semantic shift, then we would say by short period we should mean market day. But of course, the other meaning of short period also lingers in the back of the mind, so that there is an ambiguity about what is meant, and often the two are confused. Well, this is important for my discussion of the last point of my paper, which is whether chapter 19 of the general theory brings some salvation from Keynes. The point is to see, does Keynes keep his promise to remove the wage rigidity assumption? And my answer is no. So Keynes' claim can be summarized as follows. As soon as it can be demonstrated that a decrease in the wage doesn't result in an increase in employment, one can safely conclude that too high a wage is no cause of involuntary employment. In order for employment to increase, it is necessary that the decrease in wage causes either an increase in the marginal efficiency of capital or a decline in the rate of interest, but these occurrences are not bound to arise. When they don't arise, we have the situation where the wage increase doesn't lead to an increase in employment, hence allowing to claim that wage rigidity is not the cause of unemployment. Again, we must be clear here about what we are speaking. I believe that we are not speaking about the real world. We are speaking about the fictitious theoretical universe, the model. So the issue is not whether nominal wage decreases would succeed in increasing unemployment during the Great Depression. Of course, most economists will concur on this point. But what is at stake is to generate the result in a theoretical model. And in that model, it's important, as I just said, to make the time assumptions very precise. Now, what are these time assumptions? We must be aware that in Chapter 9, what Keynes is doing is something quite different from what he's doing in the earlier chapters, because the earlier chapters are concerned with a market outcome, while Chapter 9 is concerned with a gravitational process. It's concerned whether market day outcomes are going to gravitate towards a higher equilibrium, towards a normal equilibrium. So in that context, two separate adjustment processes need to be disentangled. The adjustment within a given period of exchange, the market day, and the adjustment across market days. In the analysis of effective demand, the impediment to adjustment that we have observed, which is caused to wage rigidity, is related to the first of the two adjustment processes. So the type of wage rigidity that needs to be removed and replaced with the flexibility assumption is the rigidity affecting the formation of market day equilibrium. There must be something, there is something wrong in the adjustment towards market day equilibrium, and that needs to be removed. So the removal concerns the adjustment towards market day equilibrium. Then this is not what Keynes does in Chapter 9. His concern in Chapter 9 deals with the second adjustment process, the adjustment across market days. Will employment increase as the wage, as determined in the study of the market day, decreases? But then, in this study, wage rigidity was assumed to exist. Hence, the question is, will employment increase if, so the question addressed by Keynes is the following. Will employment increase if the exogenously fixed nominal wage, say a wage floor, were to be lowered in market period 2 as respect to its magnitude in market period 1? So that is a good question, an interesting question. And Keynes may well have clinched a point when stating that intertemporally rigid wages might be more desirable than intertemporally flexible wages in the context of depression. But my point is the following. This is hardly tantamount to removing the point-in-time rigidity assumption, the task that should have been fulfilled in order to exonerate normal rigidity from causing involuntary employment on a given period of exchange. So, contrary to what Keynes, Patimkin, and most Keynes and F claimed, the rigid wage assumption, as introduced in Chapter 3, as pertaining to a given period of exchange, is not removed. Keynes doesn't do the job. To conclude, The aim of my paper was to assess the implications of trying to anchor Keynes' theory more firmly on Marshallian theory. Many authors have emphasized the need for such an anchorage, but they've taken for granted that this would reinforce the validity of the Keynesian argumentation. I have shown that the contrary is true, since it leads us to conclude that Keynes was unable to achieve his program. And more precisely, he was the main stumbling block being the conciliation of his demonstration of the existence of involuntary employment and his will to exonerate wage rigidity of being its cause. So that's the situation that should be, that's the conclusion that should be drawn from the exercise that I did emphasizing the Marshallian heritage of Keynes analysis. As a last word, let me return to Leon Foote's distinction between a theory and a model. So the claim made in this paper is not that Keynes' theory was false. I'm not claiming that. It is rather that for a series of reasons, to which I cannot enter here, but we could enter into the discussion, he was simply unable to demonstrate the validity of his theory. That was a task that was beyond his ability. Thank you.